Well, it kind of goes back to having the cows work for us and putting the manure out on the pastures and trying to be as conservative as we can when it comes to using fuel. But it's not just the fuel use, it's also our use and our lifestyle. And energy is all around us, and our farm has an energy about it. It's not just the solar arrays. It goes back to the soil. It's all energy, and it's what you put into it, you'll get out of it.
I guess in talking general energy, if you mean like farm energy, yeah. Yes, I enjoy this very much. I enjoy being out. Everybody laughs and says, oh, Melissa must be fencing again. It's one of my peace times, you know, going out, checking fence, getting them ready for the season. I enjoy being out there. I enjoy going out to get the cattle, bringing them home, setting up different divide wires, as we call them. You know, you get to walk through, you stir up a deer, you stir up fawns. You don't get to see that and experience that kind of stuff if you're not out there.
Welcome to the 405th installment of Ear to the Ground, the Land Stewardship Project's podcast on family farming, regenerative agriculture, community food systems, and local democracy. I'm Brian DeVore, editor of the Land Stewardship Letter. When approaching the terminus of a certain ridgetop dead-end road in southeastern Minnesota's Bluff Country, two things jump out about Enchanted Meadows Farm. First, the steep hillsides are covered in perennial pastures that are broken up into numerous rotational grazing paddocks. Second, a couple of solar arrays are sitting at the edge of those pastures, soaking up sunlight and turning it into electricity, both for this farm and the general grid. To Chad and Melissa Crowley, both those solar panels and the pastures represent ways of cycling and recycling energy in a way that makes their certified organic dairy resilient economically and ecologically, as well as from a quality of life standpoint. The Crowleys manage around 100 purebred Ayrshire cows and market the milk to Westby Creamery in Wisconsin. The couple came to the farm in 2003 to work for Art and Jean Tickey, who are well known for pioneering managed rotational grazing in the region. Around a dozen years ago, the Tickeys gave the Crowleys the opportunity to become partners in the operation and to gradually transition into taking over the farm business. Today, that transition is almost complete. Given the economic turmoil agriculture is in the midst of, it's impressive to see a successful handoff of a farming business, particularly one centered around dairy production. The Crowleys, who are in their mid-40s, say this transition has gotten this close to the finish line in no small part because the Tickeys have built up a business centered around managed rotational grazing. Such a livestock production system is not only less reliant on expensive inputs and provides access to premium markets, but it builds the kind of soil that stays in place, is self-reliantly fertile, and can make good use of precipitation. The three solar arrays the Crowleys and Tickeys have erected provide another kind of resiliency for the farm by making it less reliant on fossil fuel energy. Despite the farm's innovative legacy, Melissa and Chad know that regenerative agriculture methods are constantly evolving and believe strongly in the power of sharing information with other producers who are going against the grain. That's why they're members of one of the Land Stewardship Project's Soil Health Hubs. The Soil Health Hubs are a collection of four farmer-to-farmer networks representing three regions in southeastern Minnesota and one in northeastern Iowa. These hubs are opportunities for livestock and crop producers to take part in the kind of peer-to-peer learning required to step out of the mainstream and build a farming system based on living, biologically rich soil. As the current soil health revolution farming is in the midst of continues to evolve, it's become clearer than ever that traditional methods of information transfer simply aren't adequate to meet the needs of farmers seeking to take a different approach to food and fiber production. Each LSP Soil Health Hub is kept small enough, around a half a dozen to a dozen members or so, to make one-to-one connections possible as farmers take turns hosting hub meetings, not just as a kind of show-and-tell type exercise, but as a way to address burning questions such as land access, soil monitoring, weed management, grazing herd profitability, marketing headaches, pasture and cover crop seed mixes, and ways of wintering livestock. During a recent Soil Health Hub gathering the Crowleys hosted, the couple had two burning questions of their own to bounce off the other farmers who attended. if it was feasible to integrate warm season native grasses into their grazing system, and whether it was worthwhile to invest in portable shade cloths for the parts of their pastures that are exposed to the sometimes extreme heat of summer. During the pasture walk and lunchtime discussion hosted by Enchanted Meadows, hub participants not only addressed the Crowley's burning questions, but issues like paddock sizes, the merits of various forage species, and stocking rates. Afterwards, the couple sat down in the shade of a hay barn to discuss with me their transition into a farming business, the economics of grazing, and how being able to toss burning questions at other farmers is key to keeping their operation fresh and sustainable. We also talked about the role energy plays in the success of their operation, and not just the kind that buzzes through electrical wires.
So we milk about 100 organic dairy cows. The breed is Ayrshires, purebred Ayrshires. The farm with rented land is about 560 acres total. And of that, I would say just shy of about 220 is what they would consider tillable slash grazable. We do a managed rotation grazing on the farm. And so there's about 120 acres on the home farm that the cows are able to graze. We give them new pasture every 12 hours or every milking. We are certified organic, have been since 05, and we currently sell our milk to Westby under the Westby label in Wisconsin.
So I've been to this farm several times over the years. This is kind of a well-known grazing dairy. It's Art and Jean Tickey's operation. And you started transitioning into taking over this operation, I don't know, how long ago? What's the timeline on that?
So my wife, Melissa, and myself actually had the opportunity to move to this farm in 2003 and worked for Art and Jean for the first 10 years just as, if you want to say, hired hands. And in 2014, Art and Jean were nice enough to give us the opportunity to become partners in the business. And so since 2014, my wife and I have been active partners in the business, sharing all the responsibilities of a dairy that is on a dairy farm. In the last year or so, our responsibilities have stepped up as Art has started to slowly start to enjoy retirement to some extent, getting to golf and hike and bike and just enjoy life besides farming. We live on, so the farm is comprised of two separate farms, actually. We have the home farm where we milk the cows, and then Melissa and I own our own farm, which is where the young stock and dry cows spend most of their time. And we also make hay on that farm.
And you're right now, did you say you're like 90-10% or whatever kind of ownership of the farm?
With the in regards to the milk check, yes, we get 90% of the milk check now. Art receives 10%, and we are responsible for 90%, roughly 90% of the expenses on the farm.
So, Melissa, I've always been interested in your story because I think one of the reasons that dairying is part of your life is you grew up on a dairy farm, right? Over near Ridgeway?
Yes.
Yes. Yep. Can you talk a little bit about your family? Because I've heard other farmers say, oh, they're the ones that showed us that you can make a living on dairying with a moderate number of cows, that kind of thing. But it is a rotationally grazing operation as well, isn't it? Or can you just describe that a little bit?
Yes. I grew up the oldest of 10 kids from Mike and Joan Gillis. And so I grew up on a dairy farm. They started into it. They were not originally from a farm. They got into it by managing and then eventually going off on their own, started dairying, raising a family. We moved around to multiple places before they were able and had the opportunity to buy where they're at in Ridgeway. I would have been a junior in high school at the time, so I only finished my last 2 years out really at where I would call home, but my brothers and sisters younger than me would probably feel like it's more home to them.
Yeah.
And then I moved off on to college and stuff, and so yes, my dad knew Art, had gone to one of Art's field days, and when the opportunity had kind of come along, Chad and I were interested in getting into farming. my parents really weren't set up at the time to bring us in, and so had recommended, check this out. You know, they were looking. That's kind of the rest is history as far as how we got here. But my parents started, you know, grazing because they had learned some of the things that Art, you know, had taught and those opportunities.
I think it's a really good story because you were able to see that you can make a living. I mean, I don't know how many cows you were milking or are milking there.
I don't remember at the time. I think they're around 100 or a little more at this point, kind of a little more than we are here. But they were raising a big family and, you know, you had a lot of different directions those were going at the time. So yeah, I did grow up dairy farming and I always thought I would never go back to it, and here I am.
Here you are. Chad, did you grow up farming, or did you come from a farming background?
No, I actually did not come up from a farming background. I have friends that farmed. I actually grew up in Nebraska. Ended up meeting Melissa at the University of Wisconsin River Falls. Her father said something about, oh, he wants to farm, bring him home. We'll show him how farming is. And I never thought I was going to be milking cows. I always saw myself as a beef and grain farmer because that's what my friends are. And one thing led to another. And 25 years later, I'm still milking cows.
As Melissa said, the rest is history. During our kind of pasture walk / soil hub meeting we had here today, one of the things, kind of the theme of these things is, the host brings up a question or two that they would like addressed. And I guess, if you guys could talk about what were some of the questions you kind of, I got a hats off to you. You really are using these meetings well in that you are getting some questions that you get out there, because it's a great opportunity to have all these kind of brain trust of folks come on who are ranging. Some are very well-established grazers, been doing it for years. Others are maybe newer to it, but they're bringing in all these different ideas. So that's a great, I think it's, if you have a question, this is a great opportunity to deal with that. But what were some of the questions you folks wanted to address today?
Well, one of the questions was, we had been to one of the other participants in the Soil Hub, and they had warm season grasses. And our farm is comprised mostly of cool season grasses, clovers, and alfalfa. And every year in probably end of June, July, we always hit kind of a slump where the grasses slow down. They're not growing as fast because they are cool season. And I was trying to figure out, could we implement warm season grasses into our system, into the rotation, to keep milk production up? Because that is the name of the game as a dairy farm, is milk production. Posing that question to the group members, most of them said, unfortunately, probably no, for several different reasons. Number one was because our pastures are so well established, and it wouldn't compete very well with our cool season. Number two, it takes 2 to 3 years to really get established with the warm season grasses, and to do that, you either have to graze them really not intensively and maybe mow them higher and or leave them completely. Well, I can't do that with the number of cows we're milking. We cannot set aside land and not graze it. So it seems like the cool season grasses, unfortunately, are not going to be an option for us. And I was not talking about warm season grasses. I was not talking about warm season like Sudan and sorghum, something that I have to till and plant every year. I wanted something that would come back on its own, so more of like a native grass. And even with that, it sounds like because we have such a thriving system with our cool season, it will not work.
Yeah, I really like that discussion. Folks really were thoughtful about it, and some had tried versions of that, and they had real-world experience to share and saying, yeah, maybe not.
And it was good to hear the feedback, because as dairy farmers, we also have to balance grass and production, you know, longevity with what comes into the bulk tank, because that's our paycheck at the end of the day. And so hearing people's experience that they didn't really get the production that they got out of it, the ones that were in the dairy, because I think it's hard for us dairy farmers to wrap our heads around what the beef farmer and the sheep farmer get for a production standpoint, because theirs is more the long-term game and ours is such a short-term, we see it immediately, you know, that next milking. So it was good to get that feedback that, I don't really want to sacrifice not only setting aside the land, but then it's not going to gain me that much anyway, and I get more bang for my buck with what I'm doing.
Yeah, I think that was just a really good, because people weren't like, oh, don't do that, don't do that. It was like a discussion where people were like, oh, you know, think about this, think about that. And it sounds like in the end you kind of decided, yeah, okay, we've got enough information here that we aren't going to pursue that. The other issue that I think you had a good discussion on is you were considering these, I don't know what you call them,
sunshades.
For people who may not be familiar with that, can you describe what those are?
So you have a patio umbrella, more or less. Think of it as a mega scale, very large patio umbrella with mesh, like black mesh. So it's the air can still get through it, but yet the sun can't. They're usually round and they're on a cart, and they deploy them just like you would your patio umbrella would be the best way to put it. And then the cows can go under there for shade. So we have a fair amount of pastures that do have trees. However, I do have pastures that don't have any shade, and there are times when I need to utilize those pastures, unfortunately, in July and or August when it's warm. And with no shade, again, the cows lose production. And by having the sunshade, I am hoping that possibly I can give them artificial shade, keep them somewhat cooler, and that way they will go under the shade, cool down, then go out and eat, then come back, cool down, then go out and eat again. So it'll also help with intake. It is portable, so that is really good. You can move it from pasture to pasture or spot to spot. It also, by being able to move it, it's not a permanent structure, so the manure isn't always, or the impact in the manure isn't always in one spot. You can move it around, move the manure, move the impact. So if you have an area maybe that's not quite as fertile or doesn't seem to grow as well, you could maybe put the sunshade in that area and help improve fertility.
You had mentioned you think it's become more of a need to get that shade because, I don't know, climate change, whatever you want to call it, you're seeing some more extreme heat in this area than maybe you have ever before.
Yeah, I think just in general, it's just a shift. We used to see hot temperatures in July and maybe end of June and July and a little bit in August. Well, now we're seeing them June, July, August, and maybe even into September. And so by then, you know, I've used some of my shade pastures and I need something to supplement shade with. And so by utilizing something like this, I'm going to also be able to extend where I'm going to be able to graze and not have to go back to maybe a pasture that I wouldn't normally go back to. Instead of having, you know, we try to strive for a minimum of a 50-day rotation when we're at our max rotation. And sometimes maybe with it, I'd have to go back at 30 days. And it can damage the pasture by not allowing it to grow, at least on our system. And so this would just be able to be a tool to utilize our pastures more.
Yeah, and it's not people say, oh, shade, it's not that big a deal. But Melissa, like, do you notice in the bulk tank, that must make a big difference if they can get even a little bit of cooling through some relief through shade. Do you notice that?
Yeah, for sure. With the dairy cows, you can notice if they're bunching, panting, you know, really having a hard time with the heat. And right now, if they weren't to be in a pad that had no shade, we'd be at the mercy. Our only tactic is to bring them home early and put them in the lot where we have the shed and the that's really not where we want the manure. That's just more manure for us to handle with the skid loader into the pit to haul later more tractor work. And it'd be nicer to have the cows be where we want them, spreading it themselves.
So the bottom line, I don't know if there was a bottom line. Some people said, yeah, go ahead and get one of those. I want to see, and I want to talk to you in a year and see how it works. But do you feel any leaning one way or the other anymore? You're still trying to figure this out if this is something that works for you.
So if I could get the grant that I was told about last year, if it's still available this upcoming year, and if organic dairy prices stay where they are, it is something that I would very consider buying next spring and utilizing, because I think it would help with management. Like I said, I'm not just a rotational grazer. I'm a managed grazer. And This would just be a tool that would help me manage pastures better in the long run and also benefit my cows. It's not a relatively expensive when it comes to like a piece of equipment or something. It's not inexpensive, but it's probably something that if it doesn't really work, you could probably sell it and get some of your money back. It's about 21, this spring, they were about $21,000. So, like I said, not really inexpensive, but in agricultural world nowadays, it's not super expensive either. And if it allows me to maintain production, or it allows my cows to be cooler and not slough off calves or even get bred, so that's the name of our game, is we need a cow to get bred and calve every year. Otherwise, our system does not work. So if I can use it for those reasons, then it pays for itself.
Well, speaking of paying for itself, I mean, one of the things I'm struck whenever I talk to you and hear you talk about your operation here is you are getting an organic premium, which really helps, but that doesn't mean you slough off on really crunching the numbers. And you, I think you even use the term, we want to produce cheap milk. I mean, relatively cheap. We want to keep our costs down. So that sounds like something you guys really talk about and think about a lot.
It is. It's in what we consider everything, you know, when we're the pasture, it's free grass, you know, besides property tax and, you know, things like that that go into it, fancy materials and whatnot. But in the grand scheme of things, that's cheaper than running the tractor, the disc bind, baling it up, buying hay, you know, buying extra feed to feed the animals. So I think investments in what we can do to continue that and watch those numbers is what makes us profitable, no matter what price we're getting on the milk end of it.
Well, you mentioned if we don't have to run the skid steer loader to haul that manure, I mean, maybe running it a couple times isn't hurting anything, but it starts to add up.
It does.
You know, if you're letting the cows do that and all that, and they're not bunching up in a place where you have to pile it and then haul it. So it's little things like that that really add up. How important is soil health to all this? I mean, it sounds like you talk a lot about how that kind of is the basis of all of this a little bit, or is that a fair assessment?
Soil health is actually very important, but I think sometimes people look at soil health as just the amendments that are in the soil and not the entire system. You can do a soil test all you want and add whatever you're lacking, but if the soil can't use it or the crops can't use it, then it was a waste of money. Or if you don't have the life in the soil that can use it, if you don't have the earthworms and the dung beetles and everything else that goes with it, even the flies. I mean, we all hate flies probably if we have cattle, but that also signifies that we have good soil because they can live in that manure, they can live in the soil. So there's a lot more to soil than just taking a test. Looking at your pasture, are your plants doing well? Are your cows doing well? How is it recovering? What your diversity, I think that has a lot to do with it too. If you're a monoculture or only have one species out there, there might be a reason why. If you have a lot of species, there's a reason why, because you have a lot of variation in your soils. So soil health is very important to the bottom line. If our topsoil is actually very shallow up here and we go right to rock, we have two quarries within 5 miles of the farm. So if that tells anybody, you know, that's why we don't grow corn, because we would do nothing but pick rock up here. So it's not like we have an infinite number of or a amount of soil. We use what we have and we make sure that that is healthy.
And you're on this ridge that's, oh my gosh, you drive along here and the slopes just drop off. I don't know what the percent of slope is. It's pretty incredible above the Mississippi River here. So not even just improving the quality of that soil and the soil health, but keeping it in a place is a challenge. So any kind of way you can have a healthy perennial system, I think, is really key.
Well, yes, and actually today we mentioned it. I said in 2007, when we had the floods in southeastern Minnesota, a neighbor of ours actually came to us and said thank you. They thanked us for the way we farm, because we probably saved their land and their house. If this would have all been in crop and we would have gotten at 17 to 20 inches of rain, it would have washed everything away, and our pond didn't even overflow with that rain. And so having it covered and stuff, it is important, and it does function as more than just feed for the cattle. It's the whole ecosystem. It's holding the soil in place. It's holding the land here. It's making sure that we're protecting what we can, and we're also protecting runoff and leaching.
So that pond is kind of famous. I remember doing a piece on that pond years ago with Art, because he was talking about how it didn't overflow during rainstorms, and it's still there. It's still there. It's hard to describe without a picture, but the slopes that go down to that thing are incredible. So the other thing that struck me was, and it struck me at some of the other Soil Hub meetings, and I hadn't really thought about this, but it's a key piece. So we had other dairy folks here, or the dairy grazers, dairy farmers, but we also had beef farmers and some people who do sheep, and I think some goats as well. Grazing isn't grazing. There are different kinds of grazing, and I think it's really great that you guys can share some commonalities as far as grazing management and that type of thing. But also, we need to keep in mind, like you said, it's not just rotational grazing, it's managed rotational grazing. So the kind of grazing you might be doing for dairy might be different from somebody who, for example, is doing beef a little bit.
We've enjoyed these hubs, though, because you get that perspective when you're having these discussions, side discussions on, well, what do you do for this, you know, and showing them what you do or describing and getting that feedback and saying, and fully admitting that I don't have experience in sheep, but, you know, how does that work for you? Could you get away with doing this? No, I can't. You know, those are great discussions to have in the enjoyment of this group.
Can you just describe briefly what would be the difference, for example, between dairy grazing and beef grazing? Like, what would you be keeping in mind that might be different from those two systems?
Well, I think one thing, like the difference between like a dairy and beef, and we kind of looked at it today, I leave more maybe residual because I want the dairy cattle to eat quote unquote the best stuff and then nibble on the other stuff. Where maybe with a beef cow, they could get away with grazing them a little harder, making them eat it more, trample it more, leaving less residual, because they're in the long game versus, like Melissa mentioned here, you know, we have to see it in the bulk tank. We have to keep our milk somewhat up through the grazing season, because that's where we make our money. So if I was to force them to eat too much of the undesirable stuff, we would probably see it in the bulk tank, where by leaving more residual and letting them eat the better stuff, we see more milk production, or at least see a plateau where we're not dropping off, but we're holding steady. So talking to the beef farmers that were in the group and stuff, that's kind of what their assessment was. They would have maybe trampled it a little bit harder or made them graze a little bit more. But again, they're in the end game, so they can do that and then move on, because their rate of gain, they can make it up in other ways.
I think that's a great example, because grass, that's your base resource, but there's different ways of managing it depending on what you got there. And I think at another meeting, maybe you brought this up. In some ways, you have an easier way of monitoring how you're doing with the grazing because of the bulk tank, whereas it might be a little different for somebody who has a different other kind of species of animals. So that discussion, I mean, there's just a lot of cool stuff that comes out of that when people can kind of share across species and across enterprises and kind of different ways that they're doing things. There was one other thing that you brought up that I just was really interested in. And so to paint a picture for people, when you come up onto this farm, there's a couple things you see, and one is the really steep slopes, but the other thing is the couple of solar arrays here. And you had brought up energy, Chad. You kind of think a lot about energy use on this farm, and not just from the perspective of how those solar arrays are doing, although I understand you're getting a lot of energy from them. I was talking to Art about that a little bit. It sounds like it's really worked out well for you. You kind of look at energy expended in general kind of thing a little bit. I think that's a really interesting concept.
Well, it kind of goes back to having the cows work for us and putting the manure out on the pastures and trying to be as conservative as we can when it comes to using fuel. But it's not just the fuel use, it's also our use and our lifestyle. And energy is all around us. I mean, Melissa and I probably just feel this because it's our farm, but our farm has an energy about it, and we like that. We like that it just has good energy, and when you walk here, and people have always said that to us, that they just feel real good here, and it's not just the solar arrays. We put them up because we want to preserve, we want to help with energy costs. We wanted to bring down our energy costs on the farm, and so by having three solar arrays on the farm, we can eliminate almost all of our energy use and still put stuff back into the grid at times when it's needed, because we're not milking at noon, 1, 2, 3 o'clock when there's a demand for that stuff. So it can go back into the grid and other people can use our energy. And then when we're milking at 4, 5 in the evening, we can bring it back to us and stuff. But it goes back to like the soil. It's all energy, and it's what you put into it, you'll get out of it. And if you dread grazing or you dread milking cows or dealing with animals, you're probably not going to be happy, and it's going to reflect in everything you do. If you're happy, you enjoy milking cows, you enjoy being around cattle, you enjoy farming with your spouse or your significant other, it just makes life a lot easier, and you'll be happy, and that projects. It projects out. Do we all have good days? No. It's farming. Are there days that we question why we do this? Yes. Are there days that we're not happy? You better believe it. But on average, we were talking about it, if those days come up and you can deal with them and then get back to regularity, I guess, it all makes life worth it.
How much is this, is solar arrays producing? Would you give an idea of the kilowatts? Or
The two of them are 40 kilowatts, so that's the max that they can put out at a given time, and then a 36. And I would have to look at, like, the total and stuff, but I can tell you that, like I said, we pretty much do not have an electric bill. We'll have some in the winter, but during the summer months, we pretty much don't have an electric bill, and it pays property taxes on both farms and puts some money in our pocket.
That's impressive, because if people aren't aware, dairy farms can use a lot of electricity. Yep. For the cooling of the milk and the running the milkers and all that. So that's really impressive. And then Art pulled up in the middle of the field day in a Nissan electric vehicle, and he says it's completely electric, and he charges it with that. He estimates it costs him about 2 cents a mile to drive that thing. So there's electricity being used here. So that's really, really impressive. I wanted to go back to the energy, general energy thing, Melissa. I mean, is that something that you think about? You coming from a dairy farm, and you thought you'd never dairy farm, but obviously you must think maybe the energy around here is good enough to keep you with it a little bit.
I guess in talking general energy, if you mean like farm energy, yeah. Yes. I enjoy this very much. I enjoy being out. Everybody laughs and says, oh, Melissa must be fencing again. It's one of my peace times, you know, going out, checking fence, getting them ready for the season, fixing it when it's broken. I enjoy being out there. I enjoy going out to get the cattle, bringing them home, setting up different divide wires, as we call them. You know, you get to walk through, you stir up a deer, you stir up fawns. Aaron and I saw a baby bird. You don't get to see that and experience that kind of stuff if you're not out there. And I like being out there way more than I like being in the house.
Yeah, and I got to say, I pulled up and I was reminded, oh, yes, the birds. I saw bobolinks. I heard dick thistles, song sparrows. And this is that birds have always been a big part of this farm. And I would think that would really make, you know, you're getting out there moving paddocks, that would make it enjoyable too. But also, it can be a good gauge of, if you've got, for example, if you have bobolinks, that means you have really good grass on this farm.
Yeah, we saw a lot of bobolinks this year, I think. There was, I know, 20 of them I counted one day driving from where we are over to the milking barn, and it was pretty amazing. It seems like a very strong showing this year on this farm of the bobolinks, so that was neat to see.
Is that something, I mean, obviously grazing has fit with your organic dairy production system, but do you have other goals in mind when you're setting up a grazing plan or when you're trying to manage it, that maybe, you know, talking about the birds and the habitat and that kind of thing?
Well, longevity. I mean, overall, we have three children, young adults, but they're still finding themselves. We have one that just graduated from college and one that'll be starting college. And, you know, when it comes to long-term plans, we've never forced them or said, we want you to dairy or come back to the farm. We want them to find themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think that's all part of the whole plan is we're setting up the farm so that if nobody comes back and Art finally decides that he wants to step away 100%, Melissa and I can run it. Or we're also setting it up for the fact that if one of our children do want to come back, there could be a future here for them and be longevity and to show that you don't have to be a mega dairy or you don't have to milk 500 cows to pay for all the bills and all this, that you can do it on this scale. One thing that I just want to mention is for many, many years, Art did just the grazing just strictly as conventional dairy and paid for the farm that way. It wasn't until Melissa and I came and we started having the discussion, now maybe it's time to look at organics and let's go with organic, and we were on board with it. But up till 04, Art had just been a conventional dairy farm, and that is how he made a name for himself and for grazing and farming, and wanted to show that you don't have to have a lot of cows and you don't have to have fancy machinery and you don't have to have, you know, all of this stuff. Grazing, you can do it and very successfully on grazing. And because of the way he did it and set it up, it worked to bring us in, and we hope someday to either one of our children or if not another person or couple that wants to come into this and be a dairy farmer. And we want to show that you don't have to have tons of cows to make it in this industry.
Yeah, speaking of that grazing history of the farm, so I'm going to age myself here. 32 years ago, my very first LSP field day as an employee of the Land Stewardship Project was here at this farm. And so there is quite a bit of history here, and I was talking to Art a little bit earlier today about that history of grazing and all of that. So they can be a benefit or a curse to come in on a little bit of a legacy like that, on the tail end of that. You know, the curse can be there's a lot of pressure to maybe do it the way they did it, but times change, the weather changes, situations change, economics change. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it seems like you guys have been able to somehow strike that balance of you're adding your own twist to this thing, you're adapting, you're still, your focus always is you're doing all this through the lens of using perennial forages to produce milk, but you are able to kind of adjust, and it sounds like maybe Art and Gene have been flexible enough to let you do that a little bit. Again, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that seems like maybe that's something you guys have been able to, that balance you've been able to strike a little bit.
I would say yes. We really haven't looked to change too much. You know, if the wheel isn't broken, don't fix it. It's good to get different reflections on it and have these hubs to be able to, like, talk about different things. We haven't bought into, like you said, the Sudan grasses and stuff because we've seen the benefit of having the established pastures over having to till up or having to plant and do that stuff. We've been privy to the trends in grazing over the years and just looking at different avenues or things to sustain us as we see the climate changes over the years. From when we came to now, the season has been much different. We are able to graze into December like no tomorrow for the past number of years. So what challenges us sometimes is even late season is having that maintenance or not overgrazing. So we've had to utilize, well, maybe we need to supplement more than we ever used to. We used to just graze up to cold turkey, switch to hay. Yeah. So we've changed in those ways just with the time and the ebb and flow, and, you know, Art and Gene and us have all made those decisions for those changes, yeah.
I go with what Melissa said. You know, the best thing about it is we see Art and Gene's vision and they see our vision. Mm-hmm. As two entities that have come together, we do get along very well. Do we always agree? No, that would be lying, but we come to an agreement. We talk it out. We look at it from both standpoints. You know, oh, well, you want to do this? Well, why? Well, I tried this. It didn't work. But, okay, go ahead. You can try it or whatever. And that is what has, I think, been the basis of our relationship with them all these years. And having an open mind both ways, you know. understanding why Art has done something for so long. And then also him, as we are starting to take more of the responsibility, go, all right, well, if you want to try that, I guess that's, go ahead and try it. And if it doesn't work, I told you so. I just think the dynamic, and it goes back to the energy thing that we talked about earlier. We have a lot of the same energy. We have a lot of the same ideas, and it has really helped in our situation.
For more information on LSP soil health hubs and how to build soil health profitably, utilizing practices like managed rotational grazing, see the podcast page for Ears of the Ground episode 405 at landstewardshipproject.org. By the way, during my interview with Chad and Melissa, we talked a bit about a certain pond on the farm that has long stood as a testament to the power of building the kind of soil that can soak up and make use of precipitation. I'm happy to report that pond is still doing just that. If you're interested in more on that part of the story, Ear to the Ground number 50 is available on the podcast page for episode 405. In that 2008 interview, Art Tickey talked to me about what the pond tells him about the power of building healthy soil via rotational grazing. If you have comments or suggestions about this podcast, contact Brian DeVore at bdevore@landstewardshipproject.org, or you can call 612-816-9342. We'd like to note that this episode, just like all Ear to the Ground podcasts, is the product of work done by real humans. Generative artificial intelligence, also known as generative AI, plays no part in the recording or editing of these shows. It helps us greatly if you can give Ear to the Ground a rating on whatever podcast platform you utilize. And word of mouth is the best way to spread the news about our podcast. If you like what you hear, tell at least one person about LSP's Ear to the Ground. Thanks to Laura Morgendale, a Western Minnesota musician, for Ear to the Ground's theme music. And a special thank you to all of Land Stewardship Project's members who make initiatives such as this podcast possible. If you're not a member, visit landstewardshipproject.org to learn how you could support LSP. Thanks for listening.